All right, thanks for the introduction. as Martin said, the title is Entanglement and the Sign Problem, and in particular, we're going to take an auxiliary fields Monte Carlo approach. And the title also serves as my outline, so I will first discuss entanglement, then explain a bit about this Monte Carlo method, and then go on about how it relates to the sign problem and what we can learn about the sign problem coming from this. But let's start with a headline from about 80 years ago. So also back then, Einstein dominated the science news and the big newspapers. And this headline, Einstein attacks quantum theory, is of course related to the famous Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, which was published in 1935, and which had entanglement entering quantum mechanics. And so this paradox came about because they were wondering if entanglement is actually a part of our physical reality, so if it's actually part of quantum mechanics, or if it's just a flawed formulation of quantum mechanics. And it was only 30 years later that Bell, with his inequality, managed to set up at least a possible experiment to distinguish these two possibilities. Since then, there have been a couple experiments that tested Bell inequalities. The two main experiments were done in 1972 and 1981, which were already indicative that actually entanglement is part of our physical reality. And since then, you know, these experiments have been refined over and over again. And I have noted three very notable examples back here, which were done in this century. Okay, but this has essentially all been in the framework of two or at least few body quantum mechanics. So even if they use like Josephine junctions, this is all just working with cat states and seeing how they're entangled and working with the Bell inequality. The way that entanglement entered our many body world, which we're going to be interested in for this talk, is actually through a detour from cosmology. So in 1972, Bekenstein published this formula, which is called the Bekenstein-Hawking formula for the entropy of a black hole. And this is a very interesting formula because it says that the entropy of a black hole is proportional to the surface area, which I call sigma, of the event horizon of this black hole. And that's interesting because typically you would think of the entropy being an extensive quantity, so it should somewhat scale with the volume of the black hole, but it does scale with the surface area, so it scales sub-extensively. And the first example from many body physics was provided by Mark Sutnitsky, who looked at a free quantum field that is described by a density matrix rho, just as we know from statistical physics. And what he did something similar to this setup here. He bipartitioned the system into two subsystems, A and B, and traced out all the degrees of freedom in part B, which gave him the reduced density matrix. And of course, from a density matrix, we can do various things with it. Among that, we can calculate the entropy. And it turns out that if you calculate the entropy of this reduced density matrix, then it also scales with the area or with the boundary between these two subsystems. And this has now become known as the boundary law. So this was the first example from condensed matter or many body physics where this relation of the entropy being related to the boundary of some subsystem came about. And then about 10 years later, when Giancarlo and Calabrese managed to classify a large class of one-dimensional systems purely by their entanglement properties, the field really took off. And there have been many, many papers ever since that studied the entanglement properties of many body systems. And then just last year, Markus Greiner made the connection back to experimental physics, where he actually measured these entanglement entropies in a system of ultra-cold atoms. So that's a very exciting experiment. So why are we interested in these kind of laws? Well, that's because we can classify quantum ground states by their boundary law and more specifically by the corrections to the boundary law. So if you have a simple ground state, for example, a valence bond crystal, as is depicted here, then you would expect that it has just the boundary law. That's also what you will find. But if you have more complex ground state, like for example a Fermi surface, then this boundary law will get a logarithmic multiplicative correction. Or if you have topologically ordered states, then you will get this order one correction, which is universal and is a positive identification for the topological order that you have in your system. And that's very important because there's no broken symmetry, so there's no order parameter which could tell you about this kind of order in your system. Okay, so now we're interested in my PhD project to study exotic phases of matter and in correlated many fermion systems. So those could be systems that have topological order. They could also be gapless spin liquids, for example. So these kind of phases are believed to exist in systems of frustrated magnets or in doped electron systems. And we want to classify the states of matter that appear in such systems via their entanglement properties. Okay. And the method that we're going to use for it is quantum Monte Carlo, and specifically we're going to choose the determinantal quantum Monte Carlo technique, which is often used for to study systems of strongly interacting fermions in an unbiased matter. Okay, and so this is sort of my one slide introduction to the method for those who are not familiar with it yet. There's two formulations. There's a ground state, so a projector formulation, which is very similar to the finite temperature formulation that I'm going to show here. But the finite temperature, it's just easier to show in this one slide setup. So the starting point is that we want to calculate the partition sum, which is the trace over the density operator. And this pointer dies. And the first step is then to try to decompose the path integral. So we introduce this time step delta tau and have this product over L of these terms. And then typically the Hamiltonians that we deal with, they're given as a sum of a kinetic term and an interacting term. So that's a quartic term. And it's the quartic term that gives us problems because we can't integrate it out directly. So what we do is, we use a Hubbard-Strachanowicz transformation to decouple this quartic interaction to a quadratic term, and then we can integrate out the fermions, because these fermions they now move in this background field which was introduced by the Hubbard-Strachanowicz transformation. Okay, so up until this point, if we don't integrate out the fermions, we just have made our problem more complicated because we have to sample the fermion configurations and the Hubbard-Strachanowicz configurations. But by integrating out these fermions, which gives us this determinant right here, and which also gives the method its name, we only have to sample the Hubbard-Strachanowicz field, which is very nice and works well in practice. Okay, so now the question is, how do we get the entanglement back into this method? And to do this, we're going to use a procedure that is well known in field theory, namely the replica trick. And so remember that when you have a partition sum, which is just the trace of the density matrix again, you can represent this expression right here as the system living on this cylinder, where one direction is the spatial direction where all our degrees of freedom live, while the other direction, the imaginary time, is compactified to give the cylinder. And depending on at what temperature you are, the circumference grows or shrinks. So now we need the reduced density matrix. And so in this picture, it would look like this. We bipartition our cylinder in the spatial direction into parts A and B. We trace out the degrees of freedom in part B, but now the part A, which is not traced out yet, still has these two open indices, okay, and that we need to deal with. And we're going to deal with it in the way that we're not going to calculate the von Neumann entropy, but instead we're going to use a generalized class of entropies, which are called the Rainy entropies. So these Rainy entropies, they have this Rainy index n, which appears first in the prefactor, but it also appears as the exponent of the density matrix that you would calculate the entropy of. And this class of entropies actually contains the von Neumann entropy as the limit of n going to 1. So just as an example to make this more, to visualize this a bit better, we're going to calculate the Rainy entropy for index 2, which means that we have our reduced density matrix, rho A, which we square, and then we take the trace over the degrees of freedom in part A. Okay, so what does this look like? Let's first think of the first term, which is the reduced density matrix, rho A squared. So it means that we trace out the degrees of freedom in part B, and then we square our matrix. So in the cylinder picture, it would look like that on the cylinder, on one half, we have a periodic state in part B from here to here. And then because it's squared, we have the same state or a different state of part B appearing from here to here. So there's the periodicity from here to here and from here to here. And then in the next step, we would trace out the degrees of freedom in part A, but these now live on a cylinder of total circumference of 2 beta. Okay. And so in the calculation of our Rainy entropy, keep in mind that the density matrix is also normalized. So we also have this factor of trace, this is not working, of trace rho in the denominator, which also gets squared. And this just amounts to having these two cylinders down here, which are independent, and they both have circumference beta. And we're going to rename these two terms just by Z1 and Z0 because it's easier formulation-wise. So this term up here is going to be Z1, and this term down here, which is just the usual trace over the density operator, is going to be Z0. And just as a further help in visualizing what's going on, let's have a look at this in a word line picture. And actually, so now the transition to what we're doing in Monte Carlo happens, and this was a mini paper by Roger who studied this kind of problem. So in a word line picture, the usual partition sum is quite easy to understand. So Z0 is here on the right. We have our propagation in imaginary time, this time not on a cylinder, but just flatten out. So we have these word lines, which you can think of, for example, as spin 1/2 jumping around on a lattice and propagating in imaginary time. Because of the trace, there's this periodicity condition that in imaginary time, they have to be periodic from 0 to beta. So any word line that originates down here also has to have a partner, which ends up here. And these appear twice, so from here to here and from beta to 2 beta. And there's no interaction whatsoever between them. Now, what's more interesting is that for Z1, we have this part B, which was traced out before the squaring happened. So this is actually beta periodic, just like over here. But now in part A, this is 2 beta periodic, because here the trace happened before it was squared. So these word lines, they can do whatever they want, specifically at inverse time beta, they can do whatever they want. They don't have to be periodic with what happened at 0 and 2 beta. The only thing that has to happen is that it's periodic from 0 and 2 beta. And now for calculating the entanglement entropy in quantum Monte Carlo, we just switch between these two partition sums and consider the overlap between the configurations that are allowed between these two. Now, this is what you do in SSE or in word line based methods, where you actually have access to these word lines and you can sort of wind them around and find the most likely configurations to happen. In DQMC, that's a bit different because, as I said, we're decoupling our Hamiltonian using the Hubbard-Sutronovich transformation, and then we integrate out the fermion. So we don't have access to our fermion word lines anymore. But instead, we now control our Hubbard-Sutronovich field. So the implementation of these imaginary time boundary conditions is much more complicated. Now, one possibility to do that is to use the property that after the Hubbard-Sutronovich transformation, we have free fermions. So in principle, we can also apply all the techniques that we know from free fermions, specifically the correlation method, the correlation matrix method to calculate the entanglement entropies. This was pioneered by Tarun Grover in 2013, but it turns out that this only works for weakly coupled systems, unfortunately, because it's a very elegant and nice technique. Now, if you want to do strongly coupled systems, you have to implement the replica trick directly, which we did in this almost 2 years ago now. And this necessitates modifying the Hamiltonian such that it is now dependent on imaginary time. And the reason for that is that if you implement the replica trick directly, integrating out the fermions doesn't work anymore. Now, if you implement this imaginary time-dependent Hamiltonian, you will see that what was previously called Z1 is now sort of folded over, so we duplicate part B into part B and B prime. But in certain intervals of imaginary time, these degrees of freedom they don't do anything. So specifically from zero to beta, these degrees of freedom, they just do anything because they don't appear in the Hamiltonian. Just as in part B, from beta to 2 beta, these degrees of freedom, they don't appear and they don't do anything. While only these degrees of freedom in part A, they're active at any point in time. And if you're interested in the details of this procedure, I refer you to this paper, which is not at the focus of this talk, but I just mentioned it. Okay, so at this point, we know that there's these unambiguous signatures in the entanglement entropy, which we need to classify the states that we're interested in. We also have a computational approach to calculate entanglement entropies for interacting fermions. Now, the only problem is that quantum Monte Carlo suffers from the sign problem. And that's because this determinant down here, which gives us our weight for the random walk in the configuration space, needs not to be positive in all cases. So the question is, how do you interpret this as a probability? And the problem is that specifically for these systems here with frustration, with fermions, and not at half filling, those are these cases where there's a sign problem. Now, if we do have a sign problem, it still doesn't mean that we're completely lost, at least not in principle. Because now, a sign problem means that that we have negative weights. So let's look what happens to an observable. So this is the expectation value. We have some operator O, which is then summed over all configurations that we're dealing with. In this case, this would be the Hubbard-Strachanovich configurations. We evaluate the observable for this specific configuration, multiply by the weight, and divide by the weight for normalization. Now, if we do have a sign problem, then we can just look at the sign of a configuration as another observable in an ensemble where all the weights are taken as their absolute values. So we split the sign observable from the weight, and the weight is taken as their absolute value. And so the expectation value for an operator in an ensemble that does have a sign problem is given as the sign observable times our desired observable, and we divide by the expectation value of the sign. Now that's a nice looking formula that we can deal with the sign problem. The only problem is that the average sign decreases exponentially fast. So you can think of the expectation value of the sign, which is then given as the sign of the configuration weighted by the absolute weight. And this is just our usual partition sum, and we have to divide by the partition sum with all weights taken as their absolute values. And then we can rewrite the partition sum as e to the free energy, basically, which gives us this expression right here, that the expectation value of the sign is given as e to the minus beta times the system size times the difference in free energy densities of our system. And the problem with this very small number for large system sizes and low temperatures is that not only does the expectation value of the sign decrease exponentially fast, but also the error increases exponentially fast. And so that means square root of m is here the number of samples that we draw in our Monte Carlo simulation, that we're back to exponential scaling. So we have to scale exponentially, we have to sweep exponentially long to get an acceptable error. And that kind of defies the purpose of doing Monte Carlo, because the whole idea of Monte Carlo is to explore the exponentially large Hilbert space in polynomial time. Now, if we need exponentially long, then there's no point in doing Monte Carlo at all. So now you might ask, maybe the sign isn't that important. Maybe we can just ignore it. And the answer is no, we cannot ignore it. And this has been known for a long time. So this classic example is, let's look at their superconductivity in the doped-Hubbert model. So here they took a 4x4 square lattice. They doped it slightly and used the moderate interaction strength and calculated the superconducting susceptibility. Now, if you don't have a sign, if you do have a sign problem, but you ignore it, then what you see is that as you decrease temperature, you will see like a small bump, but then it looks to go down as you go to lower and lower temperatures. Well, if you take the sign into account, then you will actually see that this increases. So it might diverge as you go to zero temperature. So obviously the correlation functions come out wrong, and you can't just ignore the sign in general. What you can do, however, is you can find a different basis. Because, so first of all, we know that in the energy eigenbasis, there can't be a sign problem, because if you apply e to the minus beta h to the eigenbasis of h, then that's going to be a positive number. But that information doesn't tell you much, because finding the energy eigenbasis is also exponentially hard, because that's exact diagonalization. Instead, you can find maybe other bases, which are not the energy eigenbasis, but also not the simulation basis, which can help you find a sign problem-free simulation. And these three are examples of that. Although, as you can see by the dates at which they were published, that doesn't have happen very often, so it's not something to rely on. And also, we know that in general, the finding this sign problem-free basis is considered an NP-hard problem. So the other option that you have is to not look for an exact basis for the problem at hand, but you can also look for, you can change your perspective, and you can think, well, maybe I don't want to solve this exact problem, but I want to solve a problem which has all the important properties. So this amounts to finding effective actions. And this can also help, but there's also no exact prescription of what to do if I just give you any Hamiltonian. Okay, and that's what we're kind of looking for. What is an alternative perspective to this whole problem? And so our answer is to maybe take the entanglement perspective and see what we can get out of that, since it has been so successful in illuminating many physical properties in the past. And this is what we describe in this paper right here. So the first step is, let's have a look at what happens to the entanglement when you have a sign problem. So when you have a sign problem, you can take the partition sum and you can rewrite it as a product of this absolute valued partition sum. So this is the partition sum where all weights have just been taken as their absolute value, and you have to multiply by the expectation value of the sign. If you plug that in to our formula for the second Rainier entropy, then you will see that you do this for z1 and z0, and you get this expression. So you get one ratio of these absolute valued partition sums and one for the expectation values of the sign. And then you can split it because of the log, and then you get this additive term right here. So the sign contribution to the entanglement entropy, so to the absolute valued entanglement entropy, is actually additive. And this is very different from this multiplicative term down here, which we get for an ordinary observable. Okay, so there's hope that maybe also something else might happen if we ignore the sign. But the questions that we want to ask is, we know that the full entanglement entropy on the left fulfills some kind of scaling laws. So we have maybe an L log L term for a Fermi surface, we have the boundary law, we have some subleading corrections, we might have topological order. And this all has to be contained in the sum of the absolute valued entanglement entropy and in the entanglement entropy of the sign. And the question is, how much does each of these parts contribute? And so how does the scaling law split up? Okay. And what I'm going to show you now are all results for the absolute part of the entanglement entropy, so not of the sign part, because that we can calculate. Okay. And the first model that we studied are spinless fermions with the next nearest neighbor repulsive interaction. And we studied that on the honeycomb lattice. And this model has garnered some attention in the past. So it shows a phase transition from a semi-metal to a charged density wave as you tune up the interaction. And this interaction is to believe of the Gros-Neveu universality class, which has been studied in these three papers, for example. And this model is nice because there's one formulation in which it is sign problem free, and there's one formulation where it does have a sign problem. So it allows us to study the influence of the sign problem on a non-trivial method. Okay. So, but the first runs we did on this was to calculate this using DMRG, which is why we chose this particular geometry. So just a three-leg ladder. on the honeycomb, like a honeycomb ladder. We divide it into two parts, A and B, and we calculate the mutual entanglement of these parts. And since it has no sign problem in the Majorana basis, this is what we took up later. So this first part is sort of a chronological or historical account of our first endeavors in this on this problem. Okay, so what I'm showing you here is the entanglement perspective on this phase transition using the sign problem free algorithm. Okay, so this is for a couple of system sizes, which are up in the right corner. You can see that the two phases, semi-metal and charge density wave, they differ by the amount of entanglement entropy they have in between them. The curves seem to get sharper as you make the system larger and larger, but this is a study that is reserved for some other time, how this specifically behaves for the phase transition. What we're now going to do is we're going to gray out these points. So this is the these are going to be the exact points, and we're going to overlay them with a simulation that does have a sign problem, but we ignore it. So this is the complete ignorance of the sign problem. And just to show you how bad it is, so the sign is sort of is plotted in on the bottom. So we have just a sign of unity, and then we have the sign dropping pretty far down. So for those of you who do not have experience with these kind of simulations, it just tells you that it would be impossible to measure any kind of correlation functions around the critical point. Okay, but what we do see is that the points match up quite nicely, at least in the charge density wave ordered phase. While in the semi-metal phase, they differ by an offset. So the first answer is that we can just ignore it and we are always quantitatively right, which was maybe to be expected. But now let's have a look at the scaling of these functions. So first, let's have a look in the charge density wave ordered phase. As they align mostly on the points, we of course see the same kind of scaling, so the same kind of boundary law in this area. While in the semi-metal phase, you can see that they both scale the same, but they do have an offset between them. And that's despite ignoring the sign problem. So the scaling seems to come out kind of right. But these were also kind of, yes?
Quick question. So if right. Your subsequent size, LA, is it proportional to the length of the cup or?
Yeah. Okay, but so the systems that we tried here, they were kind of small and they had a weird geometry in the sense that it was like chains. So now let's make this more systematic. So we want to see if the system follows the boundary law.
So can you say had the MRG data
too? That was from the beginning, and then we used the Majorana formulation, which gave us the same data basically. So I'm.
It matches because that cuts the wrong way for DMRG.
That's right. Yeah, but it just works on these small systems. But that's also why we then used the Majorana, because we would have to amp up the bond dimension so strongly.
Right.
Okay. So now let's have a look at the if we actually are able to recreate the boundary law from our data. So we have this half-filled Dirac cone with the Dirac singularity, so no Fermi surface. And what we do is we choose these larger and larger sort of square lattices, and we cut keeping the ratio between subsystem and an entire system constant to avoid any kind of weird contributions to this. And then as we plot this for increasing subsystem size, so we went up to systems of 1800 sites for the largest or for the point on the right side. We can see that after some time, it actually does flatten out and is indicative of a boundary law. So what we did is we divided the entanglement entropy, ignoring the sign problem, and we divided it by the length of the boundary, so we get this flat curve for each system size. Ideally. Okay, so that's very nice. What we then did is we doped the system, so we went to 1/3 filling, which now gives us this nodal line, so this Fermi surface. And in that case, we expect to have a multiplicative law correction to the first term. And now if you plot the entanglement entropy divided by the boundary length and we plot it on a logarithmic scale for the subsystem size, we do get a straight curve, which shows us that we actually do get the get this logarithmic correction to the boundary law, despite ignoring the sign problem. What we can further do is we can now tune up the interaction. So we were at a fairly low interaction to still be in the semi-metal phase or in the Fermi liquid phase. And then now we turn on the interaction and we destroy the Fermi surface. And we can see that apart from this modulo 2 effect, which we also had on the previous plot, there's a phase transition going on where we go from a log scaling for the Fermi surface to a boundary law dominated phase for stronger interactions. And this is another type of fermionic quantum phase transition on this kind of system, spinless fermions on the honeycomb. That is, we do not yet know what phase is here on the right side, so that still has to be investigated. But it's still clearly visible. Okay, so now let's change gears and show a few results, but also show the outlook of what we want to do next. So one of the most important or most interesting systems currently are these spin liquids on the Kagame lattice. Now, one example for such a Hamiltonian that realizes such a state is probably the Heisenberg model just on the Kagame lattice. But here the question is this a two-spin liquid or is this a gapless spin liquid? There's some papers in favor of the gapped one. There's some papers in favor of the gapless one. So that's maybe not a good system to study such a method. What we can do instead is we can look at chiral spin liquids. There have been even two Hamiltonians devised in the past year which realized this bosonic analog of the fractional quantum Hall effect. Both have the Heisenberg term, but then one has this explicit chiral term, which works around the triangles of the Kagame lattice, and the other one is just a J1, J2, J3 Heisenberg model. And both of these states realize the chiral spin liquid. But what would be interesting is to see if the first Hamiltonian with the chiral term, if that could be derived directly from a microscopic fermionic Hubbard model in the strong coupling limit. So the goal is to take a Hubbard Hamiltonian which looks like this. So we have complex hopping, which introduces a flux around these triangles. And then the question is if we can realize the chiral spin liquid state coming from such a Hamiltonian. And now the first study that we did on this is to see if we can also see the mod transition on this kind of lattice with a different kind of degrees of freedom. So with the spinful fermions, and so this is just on the Kagame lattice, a Hubbard model. And also here you can see that for weak coupling strength U, there's a violation of the boundary law. While as you go to larger U, this violation goes away, and we have a boundary law in the mod insulating phase. But this is a work in progress.
So what's the phase when you invest?
This is just the so there's no flux in this Hubbard model. It's just the usual Hubbard model. Okay, so these are the results. Now let's take a step back and think about why does this work, at least in the limits that I said. So one of the arguments that you could come up with is that the determinantal approach is special among the quantum Monte Carlo methods, at least in relation with Wertheim and these variational techniques, because when you set up the algorithm, you have all the Wertheim configurations that a fermion can take. They're contained in this determinant. And this determinant is also a sign that you're dealing with a fermionic system. So you're protecting the fermionic nature within this determinant. And this is very different from what happens in, for example, Wertheim Monte Carlo, like SSE or path integral Monte Carlo, where you can trace back the ignorance of the sign problem to sort of changing the coupling constant from, let's say, an antiferromagnetic one to a ferromagnetic one, but still sampling with the rules that you set up for the antiferromagnetic one. So this is like an obvious this discrepancy between what's, you know, what you're supposed to do and what you're actually doing. And the same is in variational Monte Carlo, where your wave function might have these negative contributions, and you're just ignoring these by taking the absolute values, which gives you a completely different wave function. And this has actually been studied in the past. So in this paper, they took a fermionic wave function with a Fermi C, and they projected it out, and so Gutzwiller projected. And so in this projection, this Fermi C survived. So this is the exact result. But now if you separate what happens in the sine part and in the absolute part, then you will see that the entire log violation of the boundary law is contained in the sine. And what happens in the absolute part is just the usual boundary law. So this actually makes it simpler, which is obvious, you know, if you look at the wave function, it's not the same. Okay, so let me come to my conclusions and a brief outlook. So the calculation of entanglement entropies is very different from the calculation of observables, because here the sine problem manifests itself as this additive contribution. And we have seen that, you know, if the sine problem remains moderate, sort of there's not much contribution. So this is in this part in the charge density wave, so within experimental or within numerical precision. And then we've also seen that the scaling properties might be robust against the sine problem in systems of spinless fermions, where we were able to detect the Fermi surface, but also in systems of spinful fermions, where we were also able to detect the Fermi surface. And now in the future, we of course want to see what happens to these topological entanglement entropies, which would be a very nice example if that also persisted. And that's also what we're currently working on, but you have to go to very, very large system sizes to see these kind of properties. And so that's still a work in progress for the next months. And with this, thank you for your attention.
Okay, are there any questions?
So, you basically, when you're checking this topological entanglement, you're basically checking a universal number in 2D.
Right.
Couldn't you check a universal number in 1D, like by inducing a sine problem?
Like a central charge?
Yeah.
We could. We have. So the one-dimensional systems so far have been more difficult from a numerical point of view, because so there's a lot of stability issues in this algorithm, and they just needed a lot longer projection times, which made it more unstable. So we don't have any definite results on this yet.
But I guess you could also check. The thing Will talked about like 2 weeks ago or whatever here, the universal corner mm-hmm. contribution in 2D, then, which is another universal number. Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like not only the scaling is one thing, mm-hmm. but yeah, I mean, these universal numbers are.
Yeah. I mean, so we're not sure how the universal numbers, how that would work out, because in principle, it's imaginable that when you split up your scaling laws, they would split up some equal part between sine and the absolute part, so that the sine also scales with the system, and the real coefficient is just made up of these two contributions. So so it would be interesting, for example, to see if there's any kind of topological entropy coming out of a Levin-Wang cut at all. That is, for example, non-existent for a very small system, and then you amp up so that the correlation length becomes small enough, and then you actually get some contribution. So that's one of the things that we have to look into.
Elon?
So I remember you mentioned at the beginning of the talk that the master that by Turin didn't quite work when the correlation is too strong, when the writing is too strong.
Right.
Is there an understanding of why it doesn't work yet?
I don't think there's a very definite understanding. It's just a sampling problem, that the distribution you're trying to sample is just too wide. I mean, it's sort of a sine problem in itself. But the reason for it is not definitely known.
What?
Can we say that this finding is because the sine problem of the ground state in general is mild? Compared to instance with highly excited states where you can't even have volume law without the sign.
I'm not sure. I mean, if you look at this plot here, then you see that the sign is just strictly zero. For example, and out of this you get the scaling, and the sign is also just purely zero. There's no way of ever.
It's hard to tell, right? Because in principle everything is exponentially small, so it's hard to compare zero, like with the numerical, like.
Sure. I mean, it might be that an excited state might have an even worse sign problem, but this is even bad enough to do anything with it from a correlation method kind of way. Like,
so you think this? So because it's known that highly excited states, if you cut the sign, then you can't have not even. I mean, there's no volume law, essentially.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, that might be true. That might help us. But I'm not sure if that is the explanation. I mean, then that should also work for other methods. So I think that the property of the determinant containing the entire propagation and sort of protecting what the Hamiltonian told us from the beginning is the main reason that this works better than other Monte Carlo methods with this sign problem.
As you mentioned, like in worldline QMC, dropping the sign is a fairly physical understanding of what model you're actually studying. But in your DQMC, do you have a physical sense for what basically the effect of Hamiltonian of what your actual calculations are?
No, that's also interesting to explore, because in principle that should also originate from some Hamiltonian that we don't know of what it actually is. So if you're looking at the contributions to the scaling law and also what Roger asked with the universal contributions, then somehow this Hamiltonian should also fall into these class of showing anything universal. So that's also interesting to study how those relate, and maybe finding like parent Hamiltonians for the partition sum that we're actually sampling. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, there are no more questions, then let's thank Peter again.
Okay.